from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. All eyes on Syria. Yesterday, in a blow to U.S. efforts, the British Parliament voted against the use of military intervention. After the defeat, Prime Minister Cameron said he would honor the decision.
It is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly. Yeah.
Many members of the House and Senate are urging President Obama to get permission from Congress to strike Syria. Here is Republican Congressman from Michigan and House Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Rogers.
When we take what is a very difficult decision, you have buy-in by members and buy-in by the public. I think both of those are critically important. And right now, none of that has happened.
And on Wednesday, thousands gathered in the mall for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and MLK's I Have a Dream speech. President Obama spoke at the celebration.
The arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. To secure the gains this country has made requires constant vigilance, not complacency.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Mark Mazzetti of The New York Times, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us online or on air. What are you thinking as President Obama talks of military strikes against Syria? Are you behind him or not? What will a strike accomplish? And how much have we accomplished since the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington? What do we still need to do? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Also joining me from Washington is Margaret Taleb, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret Taleb, welcome back to On Point as well.
Good morning, Jane, and hi, Mark.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, as always, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Mark, and Margaret.
So let's get right into Syria. Yesterday, a stinging rejection in British Parliament against intervention in Syria. Here's the head of the Labour Party, Edward Miliband, leading the charge against intervention.
Mr. Speaker, this is fundamental to the principles of Britain, a belief in the rule of law, a belief that any military action we take must be justified in terms of the cause and also the potential consequences, and that we strain every sinew to make the international institutions that we have in our world work to deal with the outrages in Syria.
Mark Mazzetti, what was the White House's reaction to that vote in Parliament?
Well, they certainly weren't happy about it, but throughout the day yesterday, they were putting out signals that that they were ready to do this without the British. And I think that they sort of saw this heading towards a no vote, and they had to sort of make their own case that they were ready to do it alone. And all week, we've been hearing about how there were echoes of Iraq in the administration pushing for war in Syria. But what we've seen in the last couple of days is one of the biggest differences. You have the British saying that they're not going to be involved. And today, Friday, the French coming out resoundingly in favor and backing the United States. And talk about a reversal there.
What do you say, Margaret Taleb?
I mean, certainly domestically, President Obama does not want to be compared to President Bush and does not want this compared with Iraq. As Mark said, they did see it sort of coming over the period of several hours. It became clear that Cameron didn't have the votes. They do have France, however, and you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether President Obama is willing to go it unilaterally. It's unlikely that he's going to have to be completely on his own, but it will not be the coalition of the scope that he wanted.
Here's President Obama on Wednesday speaking to the PBS NewsHour. He said that he had not made a decision on military action against Syria yet, but that countries that use chemical weapons need to be held accountable.
I have no interest in any kind of open-ended conflict in Syria, but we do have to make sure that when countries break international norms on weapons like chemical weapons that could threaten us, that they are held accountable.
Chemical weapons that could threaten us. Mark Mazzetti, is Syria actually threatening us? Is our national security at risk?
Well, you'll certainly get a debate about whether U.S. national security is at risk. I mean, there doesn't seem to be evidence that Syrian chemical weapons could pose certainly any threat to the United States itself. Now, it's certainly, you know, they could be used on to attack American bases or ships or something like that. But it's a stretch, certainly, to make the case that, you know, the chemical weapons that Bashar al-Assad has are really posing a direct threat to the United States. Now, certainly American allies are worried. Israel is quite worried. So it needs to be a little bit of a broader case. It's quite interesting that, you know, for 2 years, we've seen the administration resisting getting deeply involved in Syria. And now, after this attack, increasingly you're seeing that they're the ones out more on a limb about going in with the British backing out. As Margaret said, they will have some support, and they're not. It won't be unilateral, but it will not be the broad coalition that Barack Obama wanted.
Margaret Taleb, how much does the president feel like he's perhaps being forced into this with his credibility on the line after his red line statement on chemical weapons?
I mean, reading between the lines of his PBS interview the other night, the body language, the way he carried himself, his voice, right, the tone, which are much of what we have to go on because he hasn't sat down with us so far for an in-depth chat and poured out his soul. But even just the verbal cues, you know, the things that he said were that he had resisted anything like this for a very long time, that whatever he does will be very limited. And then what I thought was the most interesting sort of bookend to that, which is to say that whatever he does is basically because his hand is being forced and will probably not stop the killing of civilians in Syria. This is not something that he is excited about. It's not something that he thinks is going to solve all the problems. It's something that they seem to feel that they just have to do, even if it has the potential to do very little or stir up more trouble than they want.
Jack Beatty, what about that? What about this issue of U.S. credibility on the line here?
Well, the president's credibility may well be on the line, but is that the country's? It's almost as if he's conflated the two. I mean, I can't imagine that any potential aggressor against the United States will think that we won't defend ourselves. And as to the president's credibility, after all, he's the man who escalated in Afghanistan. He has conducted the drone war. He's got plenty of credibility. He doesn't really have to do this, it seems to me, to establish that point. You know, on that NewsHour interview, I was struck by his some of the rationales he gave. As Mark pointed out, he said, that these weapons could be used against us. And yesterday, Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, said, well, probably not against us, but against our interests in the region. Well, of course, Syria isn't apt to do that unless we strike Syria. I mean, we're giving Syria the reason to strike at our interests. And yet the president said we want to strike at Syria to prevent them from doing that. It's as if the cause and effect is all muddled up here. Similarly, when he said we don't want these weapons to get into the wrong hands, well, the wrong hands, in terms of U.S. national interests, is the al-Nusra Front, the rebels, that quadrant of the rebels. And those are the wrong hands. Those are the hands that are threatening us, and those are the hands that are more apt to get the weapons if Assad falls.
Mark Mazzetti, you wrote in the New York Times that the botched intelligence about Iraq so many years ago is casting a long shadow over this entire debate and any decision about action over Syria. It's still very fresh on many minds, is it not?
It is. It certainly was in Britain. The Parliament debate yesterday, Iraq was brought up all the time. The wounds are still quite raw on that. And in the United States, you know, as much as, you know, Margaret said, you know, the president doesn't want to be compared to President Bush, and he certainly doesn't. But he brings up Iraq all the time. I mean, one of the reasons why for 2 years he said he doesn't want to get involved in Syria is because of what happened in Iraq. So, you know, the body language, everything does indicate that, you know, the White House doesn't want to do this. And then this goes to Jack's point about, well, then what is the rationale? And it's been a very curious public case here for war. And you can't diminish the experience of Iraq, not only on the justification, the sort of bad intelligence assessments, but also just how the Iraq War played out in the years that followed.
Here's some sound from Wednesday. Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee and ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is urging President Obama to consult with Congress before taking any action against Syria.
I do think we'd be so much better off if the administration would come to Congress, call everybody back, and let Congress authorize this activity.
Margaret Taleb, why not call Congress back? And is that something he's considering, the president?
Because what if they say no? Well, I mean, so here's where we're at so far. There's at least, I think, about 163 lawmakers, that's in the House, who signed letters this week asking the president to seek congressional approval. Notably, 50 of those, more than 50 of those, are Democrats. And the statement from the UK Parliament last night has certainly emboldened that effort. We were hearing from state party chairmen, people, you know, like that, from both parties urging this. For the president, part of the problem is that he doesn't want this to get entangled in a political fight. Part of the problem is that the time clock has already been slowed down very much by trying to make whatever I's are trying to dot, T's are trying to cross in this intelligence report that we expect later today. At some point, it's like, we're going to look out, Syria, we're coming for you. And then it's days and days and days and days after this case has been made.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news this hour, possible military strikes against Syria, and much more. I'm joined this hour by Mark Mazzetti of The New York Times, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Here's some sound from the Syrian foreign minister speaking at a press conference in Damascus on Tuesday, where he challenged Syrian opposition to find evidence of chemical attacks. This is interpreted by Press TV.
Is that gun?
If countries accusing the Syrian armed forces of using chemical weapons have proof of such a use, I dare them to present such evidence in front of their public opinion. I challenge them.
And yesterday, speaking with CNN's Piers Morgan, Senator John McCain, Republican from Arizona, said that President Obama is not doing enough to help the Syrian rebels.
There is no policy, there is no strategy, and there is no end game here. And until we get one, you're going to see this kind of confusion. And to announce that any action we take would not be aimed at regime change, to me, is incomprehensible.
Mark Mazzetti, what about regime change? And what will it mean if we destabilize Syria and give a pathway to a new government? Are we, you know, I guess the question is, what are we putting in its place?
Well, there's been this building consensus in Washington about how, you know, maybe the outcome that is best serves the U.S. interests is just this stalemate in Syria, where Assad stays in power, although weakened. The rebels carve out their own zones. Al-Nusra Front, which is aligned with al-Qaeda, doesn't gain too much power. And it's just this protracted civil war where one side doesn't gain too much power. I mean, it's impossible to know whether that will ultimately happen. But there are certainly great concerns in the Obama administration about regime change, about getting rid of Assad because of what will come after. And there's really very much uncertainty about what will come after. I think going back to the Syrian foreign minister's comments, I mean, lost in this political debate is the fact that there was a really, really horrendous attack carried out last Wednesday that most agree, even international groups like Doctors Without Borders agree, that was carried out with chemical weapons. Hundreds were killed, possibly up to more than 1,000. And the evidence is pretty strong that it was Syrian government troops. So the administration does have a solid intelligence case that this attack was carried out and that regime was responsible. It's just the question of how they go about selling it.
According to Senator McCain, Margaret Taleb, and others, I mean, there have been many chemical attacks. Why now? Why act now?
It is the scale of it when the others were much smaller scale, and it is the building pressure, the mounting pressure. Everyone always talks about Syria as this proxy for Iran, and part of the administration's trouble in calculating this is if you don't do anything in the face of the president draws this red line, there's small scale attacks, he kind of ramps up the response but doesn't, you know, do this, and then there's a big scale attack, and then the administration appears to become convinced we didn't want to do this, but we probably have to act. If they don't, does it tell Iran that we're a paper tiger? If they do, does it spur Iran to get involved? Where does Israel stand in the middle of this? And so that plus some of the lessons, the cautionary lessons from the administration's own efforts in Egypt and Libya are also very much playing into the uncertainty about how far do you go? What do you do?
And so, Mark,
if I could just jump in there,
please.
I mean, to add to that, you have behind the scenes a number of Arab countries who are quietly pushing the United States to become more involved in Syria. They don't come out publicly and say it, but they, more than anyone, certainly more than Barack Obama, want Assad gone. Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar. These are countries that are worried certainly more about Iran than they are at Syria, but they are worried, as Margaret pointed out, that if nothing happens in Syria, then Iran will just become more emboldened. So you know, even though Obama doesn't have a tremendous amount of public support, there are a number of countries in the Middle East that want this, want action against Assad.
They may want it, and they may want it behind the scenes, but they're pretty vocal out front. Here's UN Arab League envoy to Syria, Lakhmar Brahimi, saying that what happened in Syria was awful, but he does not support Western military intervention.
There is enough killing that has taken place in Syria. You don't want more killing. You want this killing to end. So I am against military interventions by principle, but certainly international law is very clear. Security Council has to be brought in.
So what about these two-faced comments, Mark Mazzetti, and how important is the support of the Arab League and the United Nations, for that matter?
Well, the White House certainly put up a good front on the Arab League vote. I mean, the Arab League condemned the attack, the last Wednesday's chemical attack or suspected chemical attack, but they didn't endorse military intervention. And they weren't going to publicly, because the Arab League has to certainly at least publicly be joined against further violence in the Middle East. But you know, and there are individual countries, particularly Egypt, that are very concerned about an attack. But as I said, there are members of the Arab League. There are certain Arab countries that are certainly more hell-bent on getting rid of Assad than the United States is.
Got a lot of callers who want to get in on this. Let's take one from Jeffrey here. He's in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Hi, Jeffrey. Glad you called. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah, I am in support of the government, Washington, going to Congress to get the people's voice involved in what they're doing.
You think we should do something in Syria, but we need Congress's approval. Jeffrey, thank you very much. Here's Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, welcome.
Hi, Jane. I just think that we're in a very strange position to be trying to improve conditions in the Middle East while our country has been killing so many hundreds of thousands of people, and we're still involved in Afghanistan for the 12th year. And Obama himself has been killing by at least 5,000 people by these drones, oftentimes a man we're suspicious of, and a wife and children also. So even though it's a terrible thing to think of what's happening in Syria, there are many countries having terrible times, but we have caused so much confusion and so much death and horror ourselves in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and we're still there. And now with the drone campaign killing so many more, I just don't think that we have the moral standard to go in to try to say, oh, we're going to make things better over there. We ourselves have been under fire all over the world for our 8 wars since World War II, and so active against the Muslims in the Middle East now that we are in danger ourselves.
I hear it, Jackie. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, the sentiments. Let's play some more sound here. Lots of it this week with regard to Syria. Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Tuesday that Israel would respond to any attack against them from Syria, but is not involved in the internal conflict going on. This is interpreted again by Reuters.
The state of Israel is prepared for any scenario. We are not a party to the civil war in Syria, but if we identify any attempt to attack us, we will respond, and we will respond forcefully.
And speaking at a news conference on Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Western powers will have trouble proving the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government. This is interpreted by RT America.
Washington, London, and Paris officially stated that they have cogent evidence, cogent proofs that the Syrian regime is guilty, but they can't present this evidence.
Margaret Talev, what about Israel? What about Russia? What about Iran? There's so many players involved here. How do you see it?
There are, and the president and his team are having these sort of ongoing consultations in the State Department behind the scenes with all of these players, to some extent so that nobody's surprised, although Russia is a more complicated calculation, as you can imagine. The administration itself wants to kind of get the intelligence right because President Obama is a constitutional lawyer. President Obama ran for office precisely, criticizing the way the Bush administration handled the run-up to the Iraq War, and they need to be careful about understanding as much as they can about where in the regime these orders came from, what happened, you know, what do we know, partly for the political case, partly for the legal argument that they are going to have to make. And the smaller the international coalition is, the more important that legal argument becomes.
Jack Beatty, talk about those legal arguments, the legal ground. I've heard so much about that this week, the legal grounds for a U.S. attack in Syria. Help us understand international law here.
Well, from what I've heard, there are two grounds for striking at a country. One is self-defense, and no one argues. Even the president didn't argue that there's an imminent threat to America's security. That isn't so from these weapons. The second ground is a UN Security Council resolution, and we can't get that because the Russians won't do it. Therefore, the two bases for international law for a strike aren't there. Now, the administration retreats from that and says no, but something else is there. There's a norm. I've never heard that word norm used quite so much in yesterday's press conference. They're norm. Well, that's a habit. You know, there's certainly a norm that you don't gas your own people. But even there, experts on this say, well, wait now, the opposite Geneva Protocol from the 1920s, which bans the use of chemical weapons, that refers to warfare between states. It doesn't outlaw the use of chemical weapons within a state. That is a horror, mm-hmm. and that's a violation of a norm. But again, is that, you know, that's hard to see the international law case there.
Let's get another call in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Jack has been waiting. Jack, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Just absolutely against it, but I had a question as to why no one is asking where these weapons come from. They're sophisticated weaponry, at least in employment. Nobody said, how did he get them in the first place?
Jack, good question. Let's turn that to Mark Mazzetti, a national correspondent, security correspondent for The New York Times. Mark?
The question was, where did Assad get the weapons?
Where might he have gotten these weapons, yes.
Right. Well, both American spy agencies and international intelligence organizations, think that Assad and Syria have stockpiled chemical weapons for some time. They do have their own manufacturers. They think that they may have also gotten them from Iran. There's a constant flow of arms and munitions between Syria and Iran. And there's also been criticism of, European countries for allowing Syria to get the precursor chemicals. There's a lot of trade between Europe and Syria to allow Assad to build up this arsenal.
Hmm. Margaret Talev, who are the voices in President Obama's ear right now? I know you've written about this in Bloomberg News. Who's got the president's attention and what are they saying?
Right. Well, the president, for the most part, has been leaning on the people who have advising him, dating all the way back to the days of his 2008 campaign and even in the early days, when he was a senator before he ran for president. So you've got his chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, who was his deputy national security advisor throughout the first term. You've got Susan Rice, who was his UN ambassador, was an advisor during the campaign, and is now running the National Security Council. And those are two really important people in terms of having his, he has they have his back, he has their back, mm-hmm. They talk straight with each other. But some other interesting voices are Marty Dempsey, chair of the Joint Chiefs, because he's been a real cautionary voice in terms of actual U.S. military intervention, and he is someone the president talks with and respects, a great deal. John Kerry we know behind the scenes has been pushing for more intervention. To the extent that it's true that he's not in the president's like super inner circle. He's kind of in the next ring out. Samantha Power, who anti-genocide activist, has long been a voice in the president's ear. It's unclear, although she is now at the UN, how strong an influence she really will be on his final actions, because the president from the outset has resisted this. One thing that's true about this president in comparison with President Bush is that President Obama President Bush would talk about being the decider, but I think that's more true even for President Obama in terms of really shaping his own opinions and often asking his staff to kind of help him think through what he's already inclined to do. And from the outset, he has been inclined to do as little as possible while still doing, you know, enough. That's kind of been the rule on Syria, just dial it back a little bit. If you think we should do this, let's take a deep breath and wait.
So it looks like something is imminent, Mark Mazzetti. What are the possible attack scenarios that the White House is considering?
Well, all the leaks that have come out about this have indicated that the White House says they want it to be somewhat, quote, limited. There would be cruise missile attacks from American ships positioned in the Eastern Mediterranean. They would be focused primarily on, regime sites. It could be intelligence military organizations. It could be chemical weapons facilities. They said that they want to keep this somewhat restricted and not too expensive an air war. It would not involve, they're saying, any kind of American lives at risk, for instance, planes, that type of thing. So all of they've telegraphed this all week that this is going to be, a punitive strike. It will be, as the president called, a shot across the bow. But it will be short in duration, maybe 1 or 2 days. I think, one point to raise is that the intelligence will be okay. And they don't seem to have any solid intelligence pointing Bashar al-Assad to this attack. They will be able to make a case that there was the regime did carry this out. But I think what people want to see is that the president stands up and says why this needs to happen. Because I think people are sort of looking at it, it seems that the president doesn't really believe in this. And it was evident from that interview he gave the other night on NewsHour, his body language, it's just he's been resisting it. And so people, I think, are wondering, well, if the president really isn't behind this, well, why should I be? And so I think that's what people are waiting for, even with somewhat murky intelligence, why the president thinks this should happen.
And Margaret Tell, have a sense of a timeline for any possible U.S. strikes?
Wow. Well, it is so interesting to think about it in that context because, of course, the president next week is going to get on a plane and go to Sweden.
For the G20.
Sweden, not known for its embrace of military strikes, and then to Russia, where, in fact, this will be ground zero because of the U.S. differences with Russia over this policy, because of the standoff about the Edward Snowden affair, because in fact, the president's no longer going to Moscow for that meeting with Putin. And so the real question you have in terms of immediate timing is, does he go before, during, or after G20?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Lots of news this week. Here's some of it. Nobel Prize-winning Irish poet Seamus Heaney died at the age of 74. Here he is reading from his poem Digging, from his first collection of poetry describing his father and his grandfather.
But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
The National Football League settled a big lawsuit brought on by more than 4,500 retired players, saying that the league concealed what it knew about the long-term dangers of concussions. Former NFL running back Kevin Turner, who suffers from ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, said he thought he would never see this day.
I thought this would drag out for years. Actually, I never thought I personally would see any money from this.
And Miley Cyrus caused some controversy on Sunday with a performance at the MTV Video Music Awards. It involved a lot of highly sexualized dancing called twerking. Then on Wednesday, a new song featuring Miley Cyrus, Justin Bieber, and rapper Lil Twist was leaked called Twerk. I'm joined this hour by a terrific panel, Mark Mazzetti of The New York Times, Margaret Talev of Bloomberg News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Here's some sound from Wednesday, President Obama speaking at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington on the National Mall. He said that the country has overcome legalized discrimination, but there is still more to be done, including more economic opportunity for everyone.
The test was not and never has been whether the doors of opportunity are cracked a bit wider for a few. This is whether our economic system provides a fair shot for the many, for the black custodian and the white steel worker, the immigrant dishwasher, and the Native American veteran. To win that battle, to answer that call, this remains our great unfinished business.
Margaret Talev, what was your sense of the president's focus, his message in this speech?
Wow. The one thing I just couldn't help but think as I was watching him was that the president, since his campaign, has made his race a very small part of the kind of focus of what he does, even though it was one of the most interesting elements of the campaign. And one of the things that stirred up the most emotion in the campaign from people who really wanted to see a black president, but that on the one day when he might actually really want to focus on being black and what his election has meant, he's thinking about Syria. And there he is. And his delivery was very cool, aloof, sort of detached. Part of that, I think, was that he didn't want to compete with Martin Luther King, right? But part of it is that, boy, he was thinking about other stuff. And it's interesting because there's so much about the 50th anniversary, especially when you go back and you look at the footage of the march and of the time, that has changed. And yet, when you do look at the economic statistics, education, health, all these sort of the matrix of measures, black Americans are still very far behind white Americans on average.
Here's some more sound. Former President Bill Clinton on Wednesday, also at the celebration on the Mall in Washington, noting how Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic I Have a Dream speech, quote, changed America. He called on lawmakers to honor King's legacy and, quote, stop complaining about gridlock.
Yes, there remain racial inequalities in employment, income, health, wealth, incarceration, and in the victims and perpetrators of violent crime. But we don't face beatings, lynchings, and shootings for our political beliefs anymore. And I would respectfully suggest that Martin Luther King did not live and die to hear his heirs whine about political gridlock.
Jack Beatty, what were the differences, to your mind, between Bill Clinton's speech and Barack Obama's speech?
Bill Clinton had some wonderful one-liners in there. One of them was, a great democracy does not make it harder to vote than to buy an assault weapon. Ooh. But the president, I thought the president's speech was, yeah, it was distant, I suppose, but I thought it was also powerful. He gave a picture of what has happened to the country since the 60s. The progress on the one hand, undeniable, of which he's the most prominent symbol. On the other hand, the growth of economic inequality since the 1960s. In the 60s, real family incomes went up 41%. That's just average guy, man and woman on the street. They barely budged in the last 30 years in real terms. And the gains of the economy have gone up to the top. And the president sort of laid out some of that. But in his recital of what went wrong, he didn't bring up another Martin Luther King point, what went wrong, war. I mean, it was the Vietnam War, as Lyndon Johnson was clear, that consumed the war on poverty. And ever since, that defense budget and the foreign policy that it goes along with it have diverted resources that could be used here to make a better life at home. And so it was quite a moment with Syria in his mind to be listing how you know, we the causes of our economic inequality, but leaving out this huge issue of the effect of war and the continual drain of the defense budget on resources.
Hmm. Margaret Taleb, your daughter, your husband were at the speech, as I understand it. What to your mind, to their minds, was the significance of that moment, that anniversary, for future generations?
My 9-year-old went with one of her best friends and one of her best friend's dads, actually. My husband and I were both stuck at work.
Okay.
But she wanted to go because in third grade last year, she had learned about the I Have a Dream speech, and she was very interested in Martin Luther King. And, you know, she's heard Obama speak before. That didn't seem as exciting to her until she realized what he was speaking about. And she said that she really wanted to be there. Now, they got there and were like, you know, behind the barriers and couldn't hear anything. But I told her afterwards, I said, that's the thing about going to a speech like that is nobody can hear anything when you're there. You're just there to be there. Look at everybody. Remember what it looked like. You can listen to the speech on the car ride home. In 50 years, when you're old, you look back on it and say you were there.
You'll remember. Let's move to the sentencing of the Fort Hood shooter, which happened this week. Here's some sound. Gail Hunt, mother of Army Specialist J.D. Hunt, one of the 13 victims of the 2009 Fort Hood shooting, speaking at a news conference. This was Wednesday following the sentencing of the shooter, Major Nidal Hassan.
As a Christian, I cannot say I wish anyone dead for crimes against me or my family, but that doesn't mean that I'm opposed to the death penalty or that if the government or the families of the other 13 murder victims want the death penalty, that they are not perfectly justified.
Mark Mazzetti, was the death penalty expected here?
I think so. And I think that, you know, I think that this whole story has been, you know, so overlooked by, you know, obviously for a lot of other things in the news. But this trial has been extraordinary with the testimony of families, of victims, and just the description of the scene of the attack, it was just really played out in horrific detail. And, you know, I think that it's one of the things that is on the minds of people who are in the intelligence and law enforcement community is, you know, what is the likelihood of another one of these? You know, obviously we saw the Boston bombings earlier this year, these sort of domestic self-radicalized individuals these are fairly easy to carry out, these types of attacks. And some are surprised that there aren't more of them. But certainly it's we focus so much on international terrorism. We focus so much on what is happening in Yemen or Syria. But the costs are very great at home as well.
Let me turn to another item in the news this week. Yesterday, President Obama used his executive powers to close a gun show loophole in the current background check system. And he banned, through those executive powers, the reimportation of surplus American military weapons. Practically speaking, Margaret Taleb, what will this mean? What will this mean?
I saw this as more of a political gesture than a major, major development to move forward with this on a day when all eyes are on Syria. There were a couple of changes. It closes a loophole so that people who are associated with trusts and corporations have to face background checks. And the other element, as you spoke about, is the reimportation. But the president and other supporters of the sort of major gun control measures that he was looking at were stalled in their efforts before Congress. He's trying to do things that he can do through executive power. But the juxtaposition of an effort to move ahead on something for which his larger plans were stymied, coming on the same day as him having trouble sort of putting that coalition together on Syria, show really how vulnerable in the second term he is to sort of Congress and these larger forces that are very hard for him to control. Mm.
Jack Beatty, do you agree?
Yes, and you know it happened just as the Missouri legislature is getting set. I think in probably a couple of weeks, to declare that all federal gun laws are null and void in the state of Missouri, sort of nullifying federal law. And the Times editorial today points out this is part of a trend that more states have gone in that direction than in the direction of tighter gun laws since Newtown. And the Times also points out that there are new opportunities here in this new world of sort of, well, we all have to live with guns and even perhaps assault weapons. When you have manufacturers of military battlefield armor, they've now found a sideline in bullet-resistant whiteboards for classroom use. And one manufacturer said 100 grade schools in five states have already purchased some of this. And, quote, more pathetically, there are even bulletproof inserts for children's backpacks.
Mm. Wow. Mm. Goodness. All right, let's get another caller in on another topic here. Jill is in Nashville, Tennessee. Jill, welcome to the program. Glad you waited. Hello.
Hello. Hey, I wanted to talk about the minimum wage for the restaurant workers and whatnot.
Oh, okay.
And I'm just a little confused about the whole situation because I know highly qualified people that are making a lot less than that. I know carpenters and skilled laborers that are unemployed or underemployed and working for less than they probably should be. And weren't these jobs originally intended? Maybe I misunderstand this, too.
Mm. Jill, thanks for bringing that up. I actually have some sound here from Thursday when these fast food workers went on strike across the nation demanding higher wages. Here's a Burger King employee, Kyle King, telling the AP that he can barely get by on his current paycheck.
We have people that are shutting off electricity, they're shutting off the water, and we can barely just get by just paying the gas bill and things like that. And the cost of living is just going to go up and up and up, but our pay is just remain stagnant.
Jack Beatty, these protests have been happening for months. Is it finally time to send up a red flag?
Well, it's a beginning for people who desperately need a better break in life. The
right.
the Boston Globe had a profile of a gentleman who worked at Burger King, who'd been there 8 years. He started at $8 an hour. He earns $8.15 an hour 8 years later. And ABC, you know, made a calculation the other night reporting on this. Okay, if wages went to $15 an hour, which is what these workers are demanding, how much more would a burger cost? And I expected it would be double. Well, that's not what ABC said. They said to pay for that, McDonald's would have to raise the price of a dollar burger to $1.25. That doesn't sound like it would kill business, and it doesn't sound like it would be a, you know, prevent people from buying McDonald's, even very poor people. So it's not like this is some inordinate demand, at least as ABC calculated it.
How do you see the minimum wage issue, Margaret Talev?
You mean before Congress?
Correct.
Yeah.
What are they thinking?
Well, I mean, boy, you see immigration is stalled. You see that the sort of stuff that the White House is looking at, trying to promote is fairly narrow, sort of small bore stuff, low hanging fruit, if you will. The reason why these workers are protesting is because they don't think that any help from Congress is right around the corner. And now the president has got Syria on his plate as well as these major domestic initiatives. So the White House and the Democrats will continue to make a bid for the minimum wage, but there's nothing on the immediate horizon.
Last couple of minutes here, we'll squeeze in the big story from the NFL this week. Made a lot of news. The NFL agreeing to pay $765 million to settle a lawsuit brought by more than 4,500 retirees. Many had advanced dementia, other health problems. I guess the league was facing potentially billions in liability payments, but this is quite a significant settlement, is it not, Jack?
The numbers certainly sound that way. My gosh. But of course, there's been no admission of culpability on the part of the NFL. And maybe this makes that go away. And, you know, people are wondering, is this the beginning of, you know, will someday people look back and say football, like bare knuckle boxing, was a barbarous a sport that can't go on? I don't know. The financial stakes in it are so great. I only know myself. I was an avid football fan as a young man, played some little football. And then I remember one moment that stopped me, and it was in 1964, and I was watching an Eagles-Giants game, and my favorite Giants player, Frank Gifford, was slammed by Chuck Bednarik, middle linebacker of the Eagles, and you could hear it even in the 1964 technology. And that did it for me.
That was it. Listen, I literally only have a minute left here, but I want to circle back to Syria for just a moment. After the Iraq War, there was so much criticism of the press for sort of being asleep at the switch leading up to that initial invasion. I'm curious how you, Mark, and Margaret, very quickly, see the news media responding this time. Margaret, what was the atmosphere in the White House press room yesterday, would you say?
Everybody wants to see the intelligence community's report, but the parallels to Iraq are interesting to talk about, but not exact.
Mark Mazzetti, what do you think?
Yeah, everyone's got a hangover from the Iraq War still in the government. A lot of the media do. I think it has caused a lot of the media to be much more aggressive in trying to examine the case for war.
Well, we appreciate and respect your reporting and your involvement today. Thanks very much for being with us. Mark Mazzetti of The New York Times. We appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News. Appreciate you. Margaret, thanks.
Thank you very much.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Coming up Monday, we'll look at the latest on the U.S. and Syria. Until then, have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.